Guess what I wear as a hat?
What?
A lentil.
Mom! Shauna Glassman had 5 caterers at her bat mitzvah, and everyone talked about how great that was, so we need 6 caterers.
Boss man, I need to leave early today because my shrink got me and him tickets to a Pitbull concert.
Talented comedian, internet star, and actress Jenny Slate is about to break out in a huge feature film that some have called the Thelma and Louise of abortion. I suppose it makes sense that abortion would be the vehicle for an actress whose stand-up comedy makes heavy use of the V word and who dropped the F-bomb on Saturday Night Live one time. The film Obvious Child is not an A-bomb about abortion. It's a frank, honest, and tender story about an experience that it's estimated that 1 in 3 women will have in their lifetimes, even though you would never know that from the supercharged political rhetoric surrounding the issue. The story is told through the experience of the main character, Donna. Gillian Robespierre is the writer and director of the film Obvious Child. Gillian and Jenny Slate knew they were onto something from the moment they started reading the script.
We felt the need to tell a story that has been silenced in our culture and in mainstream movies.
I think we would argue that, at least to us, what is important is the complexity of Donna's experience. You know, she makes a clear choice to have the abortion. It's matter of fact. She's not ready to be a parent in any way. But what was interesting to me when I read the script, apart from the fact that the vernacular was real to me but not, you know, precious or cutesy at all, is that I haven't seen this kind of complex experience play out yet where a woman makes a clear choice, but that doesn't mean that she's perfect in any way. I mean, Donna really, really trips her way through this, and she manages to make a lot of sweet connections and good choices, but it's really imperfect, and I like that.
Here's a clip from The Obvious Child.
Maybe you want to tell him.
No, why? Why? You don't owe him anything. You don't even know this guy.
Maybe he just deserves to know that, like, this happened, that I'm not a psycho, and I'm going to get an abortion.
A very natural conversation.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you've had conversations like that in your own lives, because, you know, in my day growing up, you know, back when the Model T was around, right?
Sure.
Know, I can't exactly.
Wait, what's that?
You get exactly. Thanks a lot. You just get to this place and you go, and then you can have an abortion, you know, end of subject. There wasn't a lot of details about who's responsible, who needs to know, you know, these sort of little nuances that you can bring in very, very playfully here.
Yeah, I think I've had conversations with friends that are very open and, you know, that we've created this bond of unconditional love where you can tell your friends the deepest, darkest secrets or anything inane, and they won't judge you, but they won't let you get away with it either. If you've crossed the line and say something that's really hurtful to yourself or to them, they'll sort of step in and call you out on it. And that's the sort of relationships we wanted to create in Obvious Child.
And also the situation that I know for sure I went through, especially in my late 20s, which is you're constantly asking the people that guard you and love you but also have to be with you in public if you are a psycho or if you are, you know, an a-hole. Like, I had my, you know, private school education and my college degree, and all of those things had been set up for me, and I just still felt like a wild animal, and everything that I thought I was supposed to do, I hadn't done it exactly, you know, in, like, the correct way. And just testing out on other people if your decisions make sense. In your gut, they feel right, but everything seems very extreme. Maybe you are gross.
So your identity as a woman involves having a trusted group of people who you continually ask, are you sure I'm not a psycho?
I think my identity as a human, yeah, you know. And then there are some people that will always tell you you're not a psycho. And then there are some people like my husband who will say, well, I know why you did it, but it
you're
was a little bit psycho.
So this group of wonderful people has convinced you you're not a psycho. Should we trust these people?
We'll call them right now.
Yeah, we'll call them right now. Let's find out.
Let's call my husband and, you know, just ask him if I'm a psycho.
Can you tell me what's going on in this scene here? I just want you to explain to me what's going on here.
Hi, can I get 2 Jacks and Cokes, please?
Whoa. You're really lasering into me with your pee-pee missiles there.
What?
I said that you were lasering into me with your pee-pee missiles.
Are my eyes my pee-pee missiles?
I'm not a doctor.
Okay.
I can't quite imagine, you know, Gary Cooper saying that in a movie necessarily. Was that improv?
No, that was written.
Yeah. So Donna had just gotten on stage and bombed. She got up pretty drunk and let loose a lot of jokes that didn't really make sense but were funny. But there was no connection to her jokes. They were just random crazy thoughts. And she's ordering more drinks and bumps into a frat boy looking, Oxford shirt wearing, non-Williamsburg face, Jake Lacy. Who plays Max, and he's lasering in with his
pee-pee missiles.
Pee-pee missiles.
Those are his eyes. I love that there is somehow a connection, right? You know, that his eyes directly connect to
his,
you know,
penis.
His
yeah.
penis.
Yeah.
I think that that is a really bold move for her to make, and that's,
he's in awe of it.
Yeah, that's, you know, the germ of their connection. That's the start of it, is that she says something that is nonsense, that is really almost whoa, you know, come on, it's just a lot. And he, you know, his smile just bursts across his face. It's so sweet.
Did you worry that the audience would root for this relationship, which is really not supposed to have, you know, legs necessarily?
We want them to root for the relationship, just not for a parenthood that doesn't make sense.
I get a sense that the agony that you see in movies like Juno and Knocked Up feels a little fake to you, even though you might enjoy those movies.
I definitely enjoy those movies, and I don't think they're fake, because I think, you know, there's millions of narratives that could play out, and there's so many different voices, and those voices are really, you know, distinct, funny voices too. Mm. It's just a different story.
Did you know how you were going to film the abortion scene itself?
One of the things I think I really drew from in the moment of just of performing that scene is that the doctor's office can be scary. You know, anything that is just going to do anything to your
body. I don't like
the
dentist.
Yeah, oh, I mean, I have a terrible time at the dentist. I don't like them. And I feel like Donna, yeah, she really needs to get this procedure. She does not have any confusion about that. But when she gets into that room, she has two tears. I didn't want her to be, you know, crying on the table. That is not what we're about, and that's not what Donna's story is. But I think in that moment, before the doctor comes in, she's the only being in there. Everything else is a machine. Everything else is something that has no agency. She's the one thing. And that singularity is at once really heartbreaking and
scary.
And scary and also really strong. You know, I think in that moment she kind of has never felt like a clearer person.
You know, one of the challenges of this movie and one of the really interesting experiences about how this movie will be received is that you cannot predict, you know, I mean, in some ways it's almost impossible to imagine. I mean, certain people will decide up front, I'm not going to see this movie because politically, no way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know what they're after and I'm not going there. But for audiences that will see this movie, you can't predict who is going to be sitting in that audience saying, oh, that's an abortion. And another person is going to be sitting in the audience and saying, oh, that's the end of some life kind of thing.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
I think that it's not clear in most people's minds what side they're on. I think there's a lot of gray area in our lives and also in the pro and anti-choice movements. And what I like about where we are now in this gray area that and the story we're trying to tell is we're just telling a human story and we're just humanizing an experience. And it's not really about pro-choice or anti-choice or the bitterness that those two sides have with each other. This is actually just one woman's story. And I think if you're in the gray area, you're going to really connect to this story because it's not political.
I think that's why there is not actually any uneasiness in the audience when the film ends, because Donna doesn't have to carry the weight of one movement or both movements on her shoulders. All she has to do is do what is right for her. And I think the fact that it's just Donna, and you just see what road she's going to go down. And that's all that we're saying. There's no, like, fingers wagging or any proclamations or agendas. I think it's I think it feels good at the end to just see a story that is one story.
Jenny Slate and Gillian Robespierre, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We've been talking for 25 minutes. We've said penis once and vagina not even one time.
Who knew?
Who knew that was even possible?
Well, thank you for letting our vaginas in here.
My vagina was so happy to be here.
Yeah. Oh, great. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.